TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Edward Said on Palestine and the Universality of Human Rights. You are about to hear part two of a talk given by the late Professor Edward Said, Palestinian-American, world-renowned professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University and fearless defender of Palestinian human rights. Edward Said died of leukemia in New York City in 2003, far from the city of Jerusalem, where he was born in 1935. He spoke 7 months before his death to an audience of over 2,000 at the University of California, Berkeley, and received a standing ovation. Edward Said gave a report on Gaza, then still under military occupation. He also referred to the First and Second Intifada, the Palestinian uprising against Israeli occupation, and the beginning of the Separation Wall. The building of Israeli settlements, the major cause of conflict and suffering, continues to this day. By the end of 2012, settlers in the West Bank numbered 342,000, and almost 500,000 Israeli settlers have moved into occupied East Jerusalem and the Palestinian land around the city. Since Said spoke in 2003, many analysts and even governments have pointed to international law codified in the Fourth Geneva Convention. The Geneva Convention states that, quote, the occupying power shall not transfer parts of its own population into the territories it occupies. Article 49 of that same convention also protects the legal right of Palestinians to resist the occupation. Said ends with a very personal description of the healing collaboration between him and the Israeli conductor Daniel Barenboim. The youth orchestra of Palestinians and Israelis that they founded together still performs in 2013. Here's Edward Said.
The 35-year-old military occupation, now the longest and most brutally sustained in modern history, Gaza in particular, has taken a terrific toll in the human condition of the Palestinians on every level. In fact, short of genocide itself, I cannot think of a single one of their human rights as a people that has not been violated with a kind of refined viciousness designed to dehumanize, break their spirit, and humiliate them to a degree that is, even to someone who has been carefully but helplessly aware of this taking place, simply stupefying. What's made it worse is how much of this has been willfully shielded from witnessing eyes by propaganda about fighting for survival and against terrorism, claims that in any other instance would defy the credulity of the most gullible intelligence. The sheer inequality between the average Palestinian and the average Israeli is breathtaking. You will say something disapproving about those terrible suicide bombers, and I will agree. But how many Israelis have had to live through the demolition by bulldozing of entire villages, blocks of flats, shopping districts? How many Israelis have had to endure missile attacks by Apache helicopter or rockets from American-made F-16 fighters? How many Israelis have to be stripped and searched at 300 checkpoints on an hourly basis? During the first 3 weeks of the present Intifada, 1 million bullets were fired by Israeli military personnel at Palestinian civilians. Neither Indians demonstrating against the British nor South African blacks fighting against apartheid faced anything like this, nor for that matter did they have to reckon with missiles, hundreds of tanks, helicopters, and F-16s and rocket attacks fired into civilian areas as well as refugee camps with no defenses or arms, whatever. In varying degrees of severity and brutality, this sort of thing has been going on there every day for 35 years, as in the meantime, dozens and dozens of new settlements have been set up on Palestinian land. And if you look on a daily basis at the newspaper accounts of what's taking place in Israel, the Israeli elections, the resignation of some minister and the introduction of another. You read down to the end of the column in papers like the New York Times and you find two or three Palestinians were killed, a pregnant woman was died at a checkpoint, a family was detained. This takes place all the time. Conversely, how many Palestinian settlements have infringed on Israeli property? How many daily armed incursions, sometimes with 60 tanks at a time, have penetrated Israeli towns and villages? How many Israeli fields have been burned? With all the ritual and fuss surrounding the planting of trees in Israel, does anyone bother to recall that an average of 896 Palestinian trees per day have been uprooted by Israeli settlers and soldiers since the beginning of the Intifada in October 2000. For this kind of brutalizing assault, the United States and Israel designed a peace process that lasted 10 years, which was not even supposed to put a stop to all this, but rather to make it seem slightly less unbearable. Yes, a peace process requiring thousands of hours of negotiations to make Israel stop, which of course it didn't at all. You have to use your memory to keep in mind that since the current Intifada began, representations of all this have been available on the international media, but they simply do not render anything like the harsh awfulness of what life is like for a Palestinian on a daily basis. Tim Llewellyn, a well-respected veteran BBC reporter, has recently shown that when one terrible suicide bombing in December took place, it was reported, he says, as if it were the beginning of a new cycle of violence, whereas the fact that 75 Palestinians had been killed in the preceding month, 14 of them children under the age of 18, went unmentioned, as did the fact of military occupation and resistance to it. Making the astonishing illegality and inhumanity of Israel's policy of Palestinian immiseration even more difficult to recall or even to see, not only for outsiders, so to speak, but even for Israelis themselves, is that, as Amira Haas writes in Haaretz, and I quote her here, a person could travel the length and breadth of the West Bank without ever knowing not only the names of the villages and cities whose lands were confiscated to build the Jewish settlements and neighborhood, but even the fact that they exist. Most of their names cannot be found on the road signs. A Jew traveling on the almost empty roads of the West Bank would think that there are no longer any Arabs. They do not travel on the wide roads used by Jews. End of quote. It's equally significant of the assault on memory and visible reality that the entire Gaza Strip, which contains 1.3 million Palestinians and a mere 7,000 Israeli settlers who control the water resources, as they do also on the west, on the other occupied territories, and are protected by thousands of Israeli soldiers, the whole of Gaza is surrounded by an electrified wire fence, making Gaza, as an Israeli journalist has noted, in effect a gigantic prison. Both Barak and now Sharon have pressed ahead with a building of a fantastically expensive wall, which, quite apart from destroying more Arab land and separating towns from their farm acreage on a vast scale, is designed to blot out the existence of the Palestinians. All of this has gone on with the full support of the United States and its passive taxpayers. This tremendous assault on memory, to say nothing about current reality, is quite without precedent or analogy in our postmodern times. Not in former Yugoslavia, nor in Africa, nor elsewhere in Asia and Australia, with the kind of approbation that Israel has gotten. The other fact I'd like to note is that even though in the US and parts of Europe, the notion of Palestine is associated invidiously with terror and violence, there is, as I said earlier, a serious contradiction to that superficial association in an ongoing and recognized Palestinian national life with a quite peculiar, if not outright, eccentric tenacity to it that has simply overcome all the terrible ordeals placed in its past. There is today a Palestinian literature, a Palestinian legal, political, and scholarly discourse, a Palestinian cinema, a Palestinian theater, a Palestinian oral tradition, a large number of Palestinian grassroots organizations all over the world. In short, a Palestinian style that invigorates and informs all aspects of this far-flung community's existence. The main thing about it that I want to assert is that it is quite irreversible and is fully an organic part of the universal debates on human rights, injustice, and the narrative of human freedom. Moreover, it's situated in contemporary awareness in all sorts of interesting ways. The habit of considering everything about Palestinians at bottom being anti-Israel does an extreme disservice to the richness of the achievement I've been discussing. As Rashid Khaldi has pointed out in his book, Palestine and the Palestinians, there was a coherent Palestinian national life well before the onset of Zionism at the end of the 19th century. And this has never been broken. Moreover, the universality of the drive for Palestinian self-determination has acquired an unbudgeable place in the world's agenda for liberation, sustainability, and resistance. Every major UN conference for the past two decades, whether concerning the place of women, the environment, racism, human rights, disarmament, health, human development, economic sustainability, has had an important place in it for the question of Palestine. Paradoxical though it may seem, the Davos meetings last month for governmental and corporate leaders had as an important component of its agenda devoted to Palestine, while at the other end of the world, in Porto Alegre in Brazil, the anti-globalization meetings featured the presence of a large Palestinian contingent whose presence assures an additional progressive dimension to the debates there. Any discussion of Middle East peace turns out inevitably to be mainly about the question of Palestine. If in the period after 1948, as part of the post-war reemergence of Europe, Israel had the status of a progressive cause, it is now Palestine that has taken that place. That since the first Intifada of 1987, Israel has been transformed dramatically into a symbol of oppression and injustice, lumped together with the United States for its imperial arrogance, its supremacist attitudes, and its inhumane policies towards the Palestinians over which it has ruled for so long. Divestment campaigns reminiscent of the anti-apartheid movement have become an important item on American campuses. Berkeley has a place of honor in this effort. And in Europe, numerous academics and intellectuals, artists and writers discuss boycotts of Israel that were unthinkable a mere 20 years ago. There are at least three, very difficult, very thorny oppositions that I want to look at now, not from the viewpoint of a policy expert offering solutions and pragmatic answers, but from the perspective I can bring, that of a humanist, an intellectual who's been profoundly engaged in the matter, but who is independent, and I would like to think as free as it's practically possible to be, of unshakable doctrinal or ideological hobbles. Take the matter of victimhood as a start. For a Palestinian like myself, who's had the most fortunate and the most luxurious of life, compared with the overwhelming number of my refugee compatriots, or those who've had to live under Israeli rule for decades, it's still difficult for me to minimize how much more Palestinians have been sinned against than as a whole they have sinned, how much they have suffered terribly in an unacknowledged silence even today. As of this moment, not a single major Israeli political or intellectual figure has articulated any serious contrition, to say nothing of accepting responsibility for the disastrous and sustained human suffering of the Palestinian people. I know nothing at all in contemporary history quite like this amazing stone wall of obduracy and denial. And yet, I must also say that the legacy of persecution, genocide, and anti-Semitism that is so much a part of Israel's history is a background to be figured in and contended with just the same. Two communities of sufferings, I've called them in the past, but one must, I think, make clear that at the present time, one community has a tremendous balance of power in its favor. The other is, so to speak, the victim of the former victim. Israeli policies, as well as the meditation of many Western liberals who feel a collective guilt for Christian and European anti-Semitism, nevertheless must be able to disentangle the past from the present, to make very clear distinctions between respecting the appalling past injustices heaped on Jews historically on the one hand, and on the other simply excusing what the state of the Jews has done to the entire Palestinian people ever since. There is simply no earthly or divine dispensation that would excuse a state or a people for wreaking havoc upon another while pleading through the travails of its own past as an excuse. My argument here that such claims do not at all correspond with universalism or the idea that human rights cannot be manipulated to accommodate what is a record of patent brutality and cruelty in the past. Palestinians have been displaced. They have had their society shattered. They have had to live under military occupation. Their lands and lives are today systematically torn apart. There are no two ways about it, I believe, which is not to say that we must simply overlook the tragic history of the Jews. On the contrary, I would always want to say that as a Palestinian, I should make my case to defenders of Israel on the basis of taking full account of, making due acknowledgement of the history of discrimination against Jews. That kind of policy should never, ever be visited on anyone for any reason at all, least of all by Jews, in the name of their safety and independence. The second opposition is the one that sees the contest between Palestinians and Israelis as a contest of nationalisms, which at their most feverish and embattled fail the crucial test of awareness, the awareness of the other. Historically, Palestine is a palimpsest of an enormous number of peoples and civilizations, each of them serially leaving traces and effects that have lasted for several centuries. It must be said again and again that everything we know about ancient Palestine speaks to a rich multiplicity of peoples and tribes, not just of Israelites, but also of Canaanites, Philistines, Jebusites, Moabites, and many others. To extrapolate from that and say that only one people dominated and is therefore entitled to lay exclusive claim to Palestine today is simply a tragic misinterpretation and betrayal of something far richer and interesting. I think that's the essence of the problem we face today, namely whether, as some believe, Palestine ought to become and thereafter remain the homeland of just one dominant people, or whether it can become the homeland of the people who actually live there, regardless of race and religion, even though for the time being they are locked in mortal combat. I don't know the answer to that question, but it seems to me that there potentially lies the universality of the appeal for Palestinian human rights. I don't think building a wall is going to solve the problem. Of course, there will be disagreements over how and what sort of equality in form and method must be achieved, but that it is the desired result is, as far as I'm concerned, the great truth of our undiminished energies as a people that has simply refused to go under and give up. The final point I'd like to mention is the antithesis between present antagonism, bitter present antagonism, and future reconciliation. Antagonism is the structure that today binds Palestinians with Israelis in the land and in the diaspora. Neither people has been blessed with a Mandela, nor even a de Klerk. We are very far from a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The number of visionaries who have articulated thoughts that go beyond a wretched, impoverished opposition is tiny, if they exist at all. Yes, there have been Israelis and Palestinians who have tried together to work against injustice and intolerance, but they are a minority, a beleaguered, outnumbered minority with very limited influence now. But that need not always be so. And there are other models than that of civil war. Let me conclude on a modest personal note not because I want to prophesy a brilliant future, but because circumstances sometimes create new things to see and new models to follow. About a decade ago, through a rather amusing coincidence, I met the great Israeli pianist and conductor Daniel Barenboim in the lobby of a London hotel. We recognized each other. We quickly befriended each other for temperamental reasons, of course. Music brought us together, but so, of course, did our common background in the Middle East. It turned out that he and his family arrived in Israel from Argentina in 1950, shortly after my extended family had completely left Palestine. Over time, and given our itinerant schedules, we developed a very warm, special friendship, one result of which is a book of conversations that has just been published and is called Parallels and Paradoxes. It's important for me to say that our friendship has become tremendously important for me, and I dare say for him. He has now visited the encircled and occupied West Bank on his own several times. No other Israeli or Jewish artist has done anything so generous or compassionate as Barenboim. In addition, he has taken under his wing two tremendously talented young Palestinian pianists, made himself available to them as teacher and mentor, as well as helping to arrange concerts and teachers for them. But the main story I want to tell concerns what we have called the Weimar Project, or the East-West Divan. In early 1999, shortly after Weimar, formerly in East Germany, had been designated European Cultural Capital for that year, I happened to be in Berlin visiting Barenboim when he was offered the chance to perform in Weimar that summer. We decided to use the opportunity to do something different. We would first audition a whole set of young musicians aged 17 to 25, with one exception, a 10-year-old Palestinian piano prodigy who also happened to be my great-nephew, to audition a whole set of young musicians all across the Arab world and Israel. By the end of the auditions, we had the makings of several excellent chamber ensembles, as well as a fine orchestra made up of instrumentalists from 7 or 8 Arab countries and Israel. We convened in August of that year in Weimar, and for 3 weeks they were drilled and rehearsed and fashioned into a remarkably proficient orchestra by Barenboim, who devoted 6 or 7 hours a day to the task, as well as going back and forth 3 times a week to conduct Wagner operas at nearby Bayreuth. My role was to lead nightly discussions in which everyone participated in every subject from music to literature, history, and of course politics. The point of all this is that a new paradigm emerged for us and our students who were, it should go without saying, from differing and sometimes jarringly antagonistic backgrounds, and whose interests, ambitions, histories, and commitments during the 3 weeks were suspended, as it were, in the interests of music. The point of telling you this story is to suggest how, despite the incredibly polarized, antagonistic, and discordant world in which we live, there's always the possibility of another alternative type of social model. Barenboim is no ordinary Israeli, of course, and I like to think perhaps I'm not an ordinary Palestinian either. But in our work and commitment to our friendship and to music making and to the ongoing Weimar Seville project, there's been an amazing crossing of borders and a disruption of the rigid lines that have circumscribed and organized our public as well as private lives. If it weren't for the rich and emblematic status of Palestine and Israel, none of this would have been possible, since it is because the complex issue itself, whose core from my point of view is the struggle for Palestinian human rights in a land sanctified by the 3 great monotheistic religions, is so fertile with possibilities, ones that reach into culture, politics, history, and personal relations, that we've been able to do what we do. Presiding over our efforts, students and teachers alike, has been the spirit of music, which I would want to insist is neither a sentimental panacea nor a facile solution for every problem, but rather a practical utopia whose presence and practice in our riven world is sorely needed and in all sorts of ways intensely instructive. At least, therefore, another world emerges as a result against the backdrop of what is now only an appallingly polarized, completely inhuman conflict. In our work and planning and discussions, our main principle is that separation between peoples, war between peoples, is not a solution for any of the problems that divide them. And certainly ignorance of the other provides no help whatever. I, for one, am full of optimism, despite the darkening sky and the seemingly hopeless situation for the time being that encloses us all. Thank you.
You heard the conclusion of a two-part lecture by Edward Said, recorded only 7 months before his death in exile in New York City in September of 2003. Trained at Princeton and Harvard, Edward Said had been professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. Said was a prominent member of the Palestinian Parliament in exile for 14 years, until he quietly stepped down in 1991. He had broken with Yasser Arafat and was critical of his corrupt leadership. Edward Said is a world-renowned author. Among the titles are Blaming the Victims and Culture and Imperialism. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Edward Said on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look into the newest programs section. You can get information how to order a 90-minute copy of the complete talk by Edward Said, including the fascinating question and answer period, by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654. For information on how to order, you can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone, or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly podcasts. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness, the brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.